Hi, I'm Trevor, and welcome to Catching Up on Cinema. If you aren't familiar with the program, Catching Up on Cinema is a film analysis podcast wherein we introduce each other to films, expand our cinematic horizons, and, in essence, catch up on our cinema. So it is the month of August, 2023, and guess what? We've reached the end of August 2023, which means we have reached the end of Action August, or perhaps Extreme Action August. I say that because the micro theme of Action August this year was, of course, environmental action thrillers. That is, action thrillers that involve some sort of environmental hazard as like a major gimmick in the overall construction of the film. You may have noticed I am the only person on the mic today, and that would be because I just got back from vacation. Head off to Boston, for the first time in my life, with the girlfriend. We went out there to attend her cousin's wedding, and also I got introduced to the vast majority of the extended family, so it was kind of a tense vacation for me. But I will say this much, have you ever seen a 6.5-foot-tall woman in an evening gown do the Macarena? I have, and let me tell you, it's spectacular. That's what I got up to out in Boston. But Kyle, my regular co-host, he is in the midst of a very substantial move, serious real-life business. So I wasn't about to poke him to record this impromptu as I am. You may have also noticed my voice is kind of garbage right now. And that would be because, as tends to happen whenever I travel, I caught myself a little cold. It's not COVID. I took a couple of tests. I didn't get the Rona, but I do actually have a head cold, which has found its way down into my throat as of this recording. So I apologize if I make any truly disgusting noises on the mic, but that's what we're dealing with right now. So to dispel the mystery as to what film it is I'm going to be closing out Action August with, the film in question is Turbulence from the year 1997. Now, I knew ahead of time that this was not a very good film. That's basically all I knew about it, though. But this has kind of been a long road to Turbulence. In a lot of ways, strange as it may seem, this movie kind of served as the impetus for me taking on Action August as a project. Because I was always curious about this movie, largely because it is never talked about. Like, I don't think I know anybody who's seen this film. However, it came out in the year 1997, which just so happens to be right around the time I was seriously discovering that movies were something that I was very much invested in, something that I seemed to appreciate in ways that my peers maybe did not as much. What I'm trying to get at is, in 1997, I was a little bit more keyed in on the marketing of films and the general buzz surrounding major Hollywood productions than your average 10-year-old. And as a result, I actually kind of remember the marketing campaign for Turbulence. It wasn't a huge one, but I do remember some TV spots, some commercials, strategically placed probably around the time slot of Q13's exhibitions of The Simpsons or something along those lines. And I remember immediately thinking of Speed, of course. I want to say that probably quite a lot of what got this film greenlit was the massive success of Speed, which is a very, very good movie. You should definitely see it. But as I've kind of been going over relentlessly this whole month, the 90s was this strange time where we had this resurgence of the disaster film, which of course was a very popular genre from the 70s. I mean, this film does bear some resemblance to Airport and its far superior parody films, the Airplane films. That seems like something that was very, very intentional in the construction of this film. But yeah, the 90s was this interesting time period where we had this resurgence of a lot of dated subgenres at the case in point, the disaster film, but it was also the post Die Hard era, which happened to be the era of no longer the Schwarzeneggerian or the Stallonean eras of action superstars. It was more, we were starting to see more actors, like guys with acting chops, do those kinds of movies and take on those kinds of roles in kind of like an everyman capacity. So you had this interesting collision of these subgenres where you had these action thrillers in the vein of Die Hard, where it's like, hey, let's put it in a novel location, i.e. a skyscraper, and let's involve actors instead of action stars, and oh yeah, let's really, really lean into that gimmick and maybe turn it into a disaster on wheels or something in the case of like Speed or this, or you know, The River Wild. It's a thriller that happens to be taking place in a hazardous environment, cliffhanger in the mountains, etc., etc. So Turbulence, though, as far as I understand, is probably one of the lesser examples of this trend during the 90s in Hollywood. But like I said, this was one that I was always curious about, and you know what, the name of the show is Catching Up on Cinema, and if you're gonna have a movie review podcast, you may as well take advantage of it to give you an excuse to check out bad movies that for whatever reason you're just kind of curious about. And Turbulence is a very fine example of that for me personally, because like I said, I remember being 10 years old and seeing Ray Liotta do his best Jack Nicholson impression from The Shining, looking through a hole in a wall that he just carved out with a hand axe, with a hatchet. Not a good marketing campaign, but one that I somehow retained in my 10-year-old brain at the time. But yeah, let's get to the movie. So, like I said, this is probably going to be a very haphazard and kind of, frankly, a shit-ass episode, being as I'm sick. I'm recording this impromptu, and oh yeah, the movie's not very good, and I don't have a whole lot to say about it, but I'm going to do what I do and try to go from the top down. That is, talk about maybe if there's any notes regarding the production of the film. Spoiler alert, there are not. And then maybe move on to the crew and the actors involved in the thing, because usually I can carve out something. I can find a little kernel of something interesting to say about that. So, as I said, I don't really have any notes about the production of the film, other than I do know that it was shot from a spec script, and apparently was in development for quite some time, at least dating back to like 1995. So not an insane length of time, but I do remember hearing rumblings that it perhaps was expected to come out earlier than 1997. Again, if they're trying to capitalize on the success of Speed, that would make a lot of sense, being as that came out in 1994 and again wrecked the box office shit. In the good way. But I would like to point out, this was produced by both MGM, who, you know, classy organization, they've made some fantastic films, but also, perhaps more interestingly, not more importantly, but more interestingly, Reicher Entertainment served as co-producer on it. And I'd just like to point out that, like, this kind of stuff interests me, these kinds of stories in Hollywood, because this is a seemingly powerful, but also very short-lived company. Less than a decade in operation. They were acquired, as these companies tend to be in Hollywood. But I would like to point out they were responsible for producing Captain N and the Video Game Masters. Captain N : The Game Master, which was a cartoon that I did watch back in the day. Never quite understood why they gave Mega Man the voice that he did, nor do I quite understand why they made Simon Belmont into such a jackass, but, you know, it is what it is. But I would like to point out, despite only being in operation like less than 10 years, they do have some quality films under their belt. They did quite a lot of TV work that I'm not really at liberty to go into because there's just too much, but just to throw out a couple of names of films that they produced during their short time in operation: Primal Fear, love Primal Fear. Kingpin, love Kingpin. Early Farrelly Brothers production, very, very good. In fact, Kyle was talking to me about it. He was texting me about it just the other day. Primal Fear, I've always really liked. My dad turned me on to that one. Escape from L.A., don't love that one, but hey, you know, it's always kind of cool whenever people toss some dollars at John Carpenter. That makes me happy. Not a good film, though. And aside from that, there's not really a whole lot else to say, but they did make The Saint, which is a Val Kilmer spy film, I believe based on a television series, that I have a friend who really, really likes it, and he's always talking about it, and I feel bad for him because I don't think he has anyone to talk to about The Saint. But hey, it has one fan out there. But yeah, Reicher Entertainment. Interesting little company. Made a handful of really good movies and then died. Good for them. In terms of crew, we have Robert Butler from... He is serving as our director. And his he to me reads as a like consummate journeyman filmmaker. That I don't intend that to be an insult, but the man did countless television series. But perhaps most interestingly, he is credited with directing the pilots for some of the most famous television series of their day, such as The Untouchables, The Dick Van Dyke Show. The Adam West Batman show from 1966, I believe, and the fucking Fugitive in the Twilight Zone. So this was a guy who was trusted to introduce to the world some of the most important American television of its day. But as a feature filmmaker, aside from a handful of live-action Disney films, many of which featured a very young Kurt Russell, The Computer Wore Tennis Shoes, I have seen that one when I was a little kid, not a whole lot for me to say. Like, there's not a whole lot that I can point to and say, oh yeah, I remember that one. I remember that being good. It's like, I recognize some of these names, but I don't really have much of anything to say about his feature film credits. And in fact, there was a little bit of a gap in his career, between his previous film, White Mile, from 1994, which was a made-for-television film, mind you, so I would count that as a TV movie. He was doing TV movies from 1986 to 1994 before Turbulence was seemingly, I don't actually know if this is true, but seemingly unceremoniously dumped in his lap. You know, you could certainly find worse people to handle the project, because everything about his filmography to me speaks that he was a hardworking professional, consummately competent, but perhaps not like certainly not an auteur, as far as I can tell. Good at playing with other people's toys, though. Like I said, he did a lot of pilots for a lot of TV series that would go on to do wonderful, wonderful work on TV. But Robert Butler, I don't have much of anything other than that to say about him, but it's always interesting to see these guys who you can't really point to any one project that like represents them and what they're about as an artist, but hey, it's an industry, man. Like just working is, just being able to work in that industry is kind of a privilege unto itself, and it's hard work, and apparently he excelled at it for a very long time. So congrats, Mr. Butler. Aside from that, the big name in the crew, the like production element of the film that I would like to point out is Shirley Walker. Shirley Walker is a composer. She composed the score for the film that has done some truly incredible work. Has been worked in the industry for a very, very long time. Unfortunately, has passed away in the mid-2000s, I believe. And also, I would like to point out, just to complete this very meandering thought, most people listening to this would probably remember her work in the form of Batman the Animated Series. She was the chief composer for that series, as well as Mask of the Phantasm. Worked with Danny Elfman and countless other major, like, household name film composers over her extensive career. But Batman the Animated Series is probably what we all remember her best for, and it is some of the best goddamn music ever written for television. It's phenomenal. And Mask of the Phantasm as a feature film score is incredible. She scores the hell out of this movie. I did mention that she passed away in the 2000s. I looked it up as I was speaking just now. 2006 was the year that happened. Truly unfortunate. And also, we have been unfortunately losing some of the other members of the animated series, the Bat series, family in recent years. Arlene Sorkin passed away just a few days ago, as of this recording. That would be the voice of Harley Quinn, and of course Kevin Conroy, I believe, passed away earlier this year. So that's tragic. That's unfortunate. All of the people I just cited were truly incredible talents. But yeah, Shirley Walker, she did some incredible work. A lot of those aforementioned household name composers, like your Hans Zimmers, your Danny Elfmans of the world, your Brad Fidels, your Carter Burwells, for fuck's sake, a lot of these people would be very, very quick to point to her as being like one of the most talented people they ever worked with, one of their most talented peers. So keep that in mind, basically. If ever you see her name attached to a project, maybe open up your ears just a little bit wider, because she shows the fuck up. And I said at the top of this recording, this movie's not very good. It really isn't. But she did score the hell out of it. The soundscape she creates for the film, and it does have quite a lot of music, is admirable. Like, her choices in instrumentation and the cadences that she utilizes to kind of babysit the edit of the film a little bit, go a long way towards making it a tolerable experience. Because it's not a good film. No, I'll just say that much. But it doesn't sound that bad. So take from that what you will. But as far as our cast goes, speaking of people who have unfortunately passed away, Ray Liotta is top billed in this film. He unfortunately passed away last year, I believe, and he is actually still having films that he acted in released posthumously. I believe there are a handful more. In fact, I'm looking at right now. The Substance, Dangerous Waters, and April 29th, 1992 are all films that he acted in that have yet to be released. So we have yet to see the last of Ray Liotta. Ray Liotta, as far as I know, got his start, like, what launched him was, of course, the starring role in Goodfellas, Martin Scorsese's Goodfellas as Henry Hill. But just prior to that, he was also an important but very small role in Field of Dreams. So 1989 to 1990 was kind of like what announced his arrival in Hollywood. However, as far as I understand, he never quite attained that, like, put asses in seats, like, level of stardom. Like, I've never had a problem with him as an actor, but I have a phrase that I often use when I speak of actors that maybe seems kind of mean, but I say I wouldn't show up for them, basically. Like not a selling point is the phrase that I often use. And I think of actors sometimes in those terms, where it's like, I appreciate that person being there. Like, I value them as a screen presence or as an actor, or usually a character actor. But my decision-making would not be swayed whether they were there or not. Like, if I was deciding to buy a ticket or not, like, them being there or not wouldn't make a difference to me. And unfortunately, Ray Liotta's kind of always been that for me. I usually appreciate him. I've never had a problem with him, but I don't think I've ever sought out a movie because I heard he was in it. Funny enough, a film that I did not review, as far as I recall, like, I am a little bit delirious right now, being as I have a pretty awful head cold as I'm recording this, but a movie I think I watched but did not record a review of was No Escape from 1994, which is an action film directed by Martin Campbell, starring Ray Liotta, that very similar to Turbulence. Maybe there's a thing here. Maybe Ray Liotta isn't a selling point for me, but he is a point of curiosity for me. No Escape was a movie that I have mentioned on the podcast a handful of times because it came out in 1994, which just so happened to be roughly the time period wherein my brother, my older brother, was kind of dabbling in the world of superhero comics, so both Marvel and DC at the time. And No Escape was this movie that I never saw a fucking commercial for, not once, but I remember seeing the box art of it at the grocery store because there was a Super Nintendo game of it that, as far as I understand, is complete garbage. And also, it had full-page ads in almost every comic book that my brother had. And it's the image is Ernie Hudson and Ray Liotta. There's a third person on the cover. I can't remember who it is. Maybe it was Lance Henriksen. But it's Ray Liotta brandishing like a fucking rocket launcher, a bazooka, pointing it towards you, the viewer. That's the poster for the movie. And that's seared into my memory because I saw it in like literally every comic book we had in the house in the 90s. So several months ago, I ended up watching that again, a Ray Liotta headlined film directed by Martin Campbell prior to his tenure on the Bond series in the form of GoldenEye, as well as The Mask of Zorro. Martin Campbell is one of those directors that I will show up for. For fuck's sake, he gave us two excellent James Bond films, and The Mask of Zorro is a fucking classic. Doesn't get talked about enough. Love that movie. But I was curious, because I was curious about him. I was curious about this movie with this shitty Super Nintendo adaptation. So I did watch it. It's fine. Like, it does actually have some pretty cool violence. Like, it has some pretty savage, pretty inventive violence, which, as I stated in my review of the Liam Neeson headlined film Memory, also directed by Martin Campbell, Mr. Campbell seems to have a thing about, like, novel instances of violence in his films. Like, when people get beat the fuck up or get blowed the fuck up in his movies, it's usually in a somewhat unique way, or in a somewhat uniquely savage way. And you definitely get that in No Escape, even though the movie is kind of ho-hum. But yeah, I watched that, so long story short, there's your micro-review of No Escape. It's got some good violence. It's an okay movie. But, like I said, Ray Liotta, not a huge selling point for me. Very, very, very consistently hard-working actor in Hollywood. And in fact, if you look at his Wikipedia, there's a lovely quote from him in 2018, as far as I can tell. You want to do as many different genres as you can, and that's what I've been doing. I've done movies with the Muppets. By the way, that is a plural. He has been in multiple Muppet films. I did Sinatra. I did Good Guys and Bad Guys. I did a movie with an elephant. He's referring to Operation Dumbo Drop, a movie I believe I saw in theaters when I was a kid. I decided that I was here to try different parts and do different things. That's what it's really all about. That's what a career should be. And you know what? I think a lot of actors have that exact speech in their back pocket, maybe omitting the part about being in Operation Dumbo Drop. But he actually did it. Like if you look over his filmography, that is something you can credit him with, is that he did stretch his wings a little bit. Like, he had some range. Like, I know he was sometimes accused of being an over actor, but, you know, he's played hard-boiled cops. Like he played a squirrely, kind of like on the fringe cop in Copland, if memory serves. He plays the fucking Joker in this, by the way. And in stark contrast to that, though, you have things like Blow, where he plays basically the warmest, most loving father that's ever been in a crime thriller. Like, really, look up his performance in that. He's an interesting character in that. He loves his goddamn son, even though his son's a fuck-up. And then he bounces on down to, like, fucking Wild Hogs, and he's playing a loudmouth biker that wants to get in fistfights with Tim Allen. I've seen that movie an inordinately large number of times. A lot of Tim Allen movies, in fact, I kind of have that relationship with. Like, Joe Somebody is a movie I have threatened Kyle with countless times, because I have seen Joe Somebody so many goddamn times, and same with Wild Hogs. I don't know why. I think it was because those came out and I was probably like living at my parents' house or something, and they still had the premium channel. So I was like, what's on Encore right now? Fucking Wild Hogs? Let's go. Joe Somebody? Let's fucking go. Buzz on Buzz Violence. If you're not aware, the gimmick of Joe Somebody is that Tim Allen, aka the voice of the theatrical version of Buzz Lightyear, wants to do battle with Patrick Warburton, aka Putty from television Seinfeld, aka the television voice of the Buzz Lightyear character. So it's the Battle of the Buzzes. That should have been the subtitle of that movie. But kind of the remarkable thing about Ray Liotta is that you bounce on down to his final active years in Hollywood, final active years as a person and as an actor, and he got some winners on the tail end of his resume. It's kind of cool how that worked out. The big one is probably going to be Marriage Story. As far as I understand, very, very heavy drama film written and directed by Noah Baumbach. I heard very good things about his role in that. That came out in 2019. Hubie Halloween. I don't know the extent of his role in that, but I have heard that movie's not bad. I would watch that. Adam Sandler doing a stupid voice in a Halloween movie? Sure, why not? And Ray Liotta's here too? Why not? The Many Saints of Newark. I don't know if that was any good, but Ray Liotta in a fucking Sopranos movie, like, talk about stunt casting. It's like, yeah, he should have been on that show at some point. May as well put him in the movie. And then, of course, Cocaine Bear. I heard that kind of sucked. And as far as I understand, like, he's not represented well in that film, which is kind of unfortunate. But hey, he got Marriage Story. Anyway, that's enough about Ray Liotta. Let's bounce on down to Lauren Holly, who I don't have a whole lot to say about. She's kind of one of those actresses for me. She's, you know, I recognize her. I wouldn't have been able to tell you her name off the top of my head unless I looked it up, which I just did. As far as I know, her big break came in the form of Picket Fences, which was a Tom Skerritt headlined television series from the early 90s when I wasn't watching those kinds of shows. I was too busy watching fucking Nickelodeon, Nicktoons and stuff. I have to throw that out there because Tom Skerritt is a resident of the Seattle area, of which I am a lifelong native of. So we like Tom Skerritt is what I'm trying to say. We here at Catching Up on Cinema, we appreciate Tom Skerritt, especially when he shows up at Scarecrow Video and does YouTube videos. But aside from that, trivia factoid, she was very briefly married to Jim Carrey. As far as I understand, they met around the time Ace Ventura was coming out. And of course, she had a role in Dumb and Dumber not too long after. So they got to know each other pretty well, but they were very briefly married. Kind of strange how that worked out. She plays Linda Lee in Dragon the Bruce Lee Story. As I said, she's in Dumb and Dumber. She was in Down Periscope, but I get my wires crossed because I think that was a Deep Impact Armageddon situation between Down Periscope and McHale's Navy. I think I like Down Periscope better because I really liked Kelsey Grammer at that point. Frasier was really big in my house when I was young. Then she was in this. But funny enough, the thing I probably remember her best from was Any Given Sunday, which is a movie that we did review here at Catching Up on Cinema during our sports movie month. Oliver Stone's Any Given Sunday. She plays Dennis Quaid's wife in that, and she's not a huge character. It's a massive ensemble cast. But she has this one scene with Dennis Quaid where she tells him, "You're a goddamn football player and you will get back on that fucking horse." It's like, holy shit. Like, it's a pretty juicy scene. And she does pretty well with it. But she is the star of this movie, even though Ray Liotta is top billed. And I feel like, unfortunately, she's not quite up to the task of carrying this movie on her shoulders. partially because it's a little bit unfair. So I should probably get to the movie itself. I will point out that Hector Elizondo is here as well in a kind of a small role, but an important one. Always liked him. He shows the fuck up in every role that he's ever taken. Rachel Ticotin is in here as well. Not somebody you see all the time, but always appreciated. We also have Catherine Hicks. She gets choked out by Ray Liotta. It's a pretty savage sequence, maybe the most savage in the whole movie. But probably the big weird one is Brendan Gleeson is in here. 1997 Brendan Gleeson, which would probably put this movie not too far from Lake Placid territory. But he's doing a southern accent. He's got a neck tattoo and he's playing a crazed bank robber guy who ends up going on a fucking killing spree just prior to the halfway mark of the movie. Very strange casting. Very strange. We also have previously featured on Catching Up on Cinema, Ben Cross, who plays a British pilot with a lovely speaking voice. He was featured on a very early episode of Catching Up on Cinema in the form of Undisputed 2, Last Man Standing, aka the movie that introduced me to Scott Adkins, as well as friend of the show, Brad from the Cinema Speak podcast, his pick for a retro review, The Hurricane Heist. He plays kind of a major villain role in that film. Not the major villain role, but like a secondary villain role in that, where he's kind of similar to Brendan Gleeson in this, taking his UK accent and, or I don't know if Brendan Gleeson's Irish. He's probably Irish. I probably fucked that up. Yes, he's Irish. So Ben Cross is British. Brendan Gleeson is Irish. Apologies to those who care. You know who you are. Ben Cross is taking his English accent and squishing it down into a southern drawl, which I want to say is probably just easier than like entirely flattening it out to like, say, trying to do a Pacific Northwestern American accent for a British person. I bet that's really hard. And then Grandel Bush is in here as well. That would be Balrog. From the 1994 Street Fighter film, as well as, very important, being as we're talking about 1990s action thrillers, and I did mention Die Hard being like a possible catalyst for the deluge of these kinds of films that we got all through the 90s, one of which, of course, includes Die Hard 2, which also features fucking planes. Grandel Bush was also one of the Johnsons, one of the FBI agents in Die Hard, the original Die Hard. Robert Davi was the other Johnson. Grandel Bush is the one that calls Robert Davi a dickhead. I was in junior high, dickhead. One of my favorite lines in that movie. He's here briefly. He gets stabbed. It's pretty fucking gnarly. So to talk about the fucking movie, Turbulence is a action, it's a thriller, I guess. Oh no, it is classified as an action thriller, short on action, mostly a thriller. That is about a 747 that has like 11 people on it. That doesn't seem cost efficient, if you ask me. Like, what's funny about the timing of this is that I just flew twice in the past week. I can attest to the fact that the airline situation in the U.S. is truly fucked. We had severe delays, seemingly for no reason. We got a lot of PA announcements about our pilots not yet being at the terminal and having to be flown in from fucking Michigan. It's like, are they flying that plane from Michigan? Are they, like, fatigued? I'm getting worried. But yeah, we had, like, multiple delays. It was Delta flight, by the way, if anybody's curious. So what I'm trying to get at is like flying is kind of it's a very expensive endeavor these days. And it's also known to be not especially well organized these days because they attribute it to work shortages. I don't know if it's just raw economics. I don't know what the culprit is, but when I see a 747 with 11 people on it flying cross country in this film, it grinds my gears a little bit, where I'm like, that's a lot of fuel to be burning for 11 fucking people. It's, come on, man. But yeah, it's an action thriller that takes place on a 747 that's flying from New York to LA. And Ray Liotta plays a accused serial killer. It isn't like 100% confirmed until about the midway point that he actually is guilty of his crimes, because he fucking confesses to them on a phone while he's yelling at the detective who arrested him for his said crimes. Very strange and very sudden turn for his character. And basically it's a crisis situation in a confined space in the form of a a plane in flight. So our hero is Lauren Holly, who is a flight attendant, and Ray Liotta is the aforementioned serial killer. And it kind of turns into like a lame slasher thriller, because there's no slashing to be done, is what I'm saying. But that's kind of what it turns into. It turns into like a quote cat and mouse. Unfortunately, it's a fucking plane, and really all it is just a long corridor. So there's really nowhere to hide, and there's really no interesting places to go other than the avionics, in the avionics bay, like in the underbelly of the thing, which they have a stop in for like 2 seconds in towards the end of the film. The structure of this film is probably its biggest weakness. It has some cool stuff. It has some cool ideas. Unfortunately, most of them get exhausted within the first half hour, and you're left with a lot of meandering. The blocking of this film in particular, that is like the positioning of the characters in the frame and the way they negotiate their space, is one of the most frustrating things in it. It's because, again, it's a fucking passenger plane. It's a corridor. You go up and down the aisle. And they do that literally in the film, is you get to see characters walk back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And there's like a clunkiness, like a clumsiness to it, a lack of coordination in the way the action is structured in the film. And I say action in super tiny air quotes, because there ain't none, really. It's mostly just people falling on top of each other when the plane starts going out of control. But yeah, the film starts with Ray Liotta being arrested by Hector Elizondo, who is a detective from L.A., and then they decide to put both him and Brendan Gleeson, who is a bank robber, on this 747 that has a flight crew and like a handful of passengers. Like I said, there's like 11 people total on this plane. So right off the bat, it's like, oh, well, that's... it's not a whole lot of bodies. Like, if we're trying to rack up a body count, I guess that rules that out. But more importantly, in terms of characters, the movie has very little to offer, because it goes out of its way to take the very small number of characters available to itself and reduce that number even further very quickly. And it's a very strange choice. It feels like the movie shot itself in the foot, and I have to assume it's like a writing thing, because again, the structure of the film, like the premise holds water until it doesn't. Like it starts out, like it sounds interesting at first. Like it's a couple of psychopaths hijack a plane or something. It just happens to be a passenger plane or something. Wow, that sounds kind of neat. Except when all of the passengers get stuffed into a fucking closet less than halfway into the movie, and everybody who's going to die dies within the first half of the movie. So what do we do for the second half? It's like, well, we have this quote handsome British man with a really cool voice talk this flight attendant lady how to engage the autopilot, not actually fly the plane, just engage the autopilot. And then Ray Liotta comes after her every few minutes, and she keeps getting away, and she keeps having these flashes where she just gets really dumb for no real reason. Oh, I don't mean no real reason. I mean because we wouldn't have a movie otherwise. It's a very, very clumsily structured film. Very tragically clumsy structure, unfortunately. But I will say, like, the early goings offer some promise. Unfortunately, something that I guess I should have led this conversation with, I don't know why my brain works this way. I go down all these weird tangents and I lose track of like perhaps the things that should be said earliest. So past several times I've had to do these solo recordings, I've often forgotten to state anything about the composers of the scores for the film, which is something I'm very passionate about. I did that this time. I did talk at length about Shirley Walker, so hey, I corrected that. What I should have led with in talking about Turbulence is the year that it came out. So I don't know what it was about the 90s. Maybe, again, it was like that nostalgia factor for disaster films of the 70s or something, but there were a lot of action thrillers that took place on planes. Like, without doing research, I can rattle off, I mean, Executive Decision, Terminal Velocity, Drop Zone, but more importantly, oh yeah, Die Hard 2, Die Harder, takes place at a fucking airport, features prominently a 747 in an action set piece towards the end of the film. Grandel Bush is in one of those films. But more importantly, 1997 just happened to be a very interesting year for airplanes and in action films. So in case you're not aware of what I'm alluding to here, Turbulence came out in January. However, by the time you get to summer, you would have the 1-2 punch of Con Air and Air Force One, both of which being beloved massive action blockbuster films from the 90s, both of which being much better films than this one, both of which being action films that involve, to a great degree, planes as a central component of the structure of the film. Funny enough, Con Air involves, a bunch of convicts, a bunch of serial killers, a bunch of crazed psychopath characters on a plane with not civilian personnel, but, you know, innocent people and whatnot. In fact, I could be wrong, but I think Rachel Ticotin, I could be wrong. I'm going to look it up right now. I'm pretty sure she was in Con Air. I'm going to look this shit up because I got to know. Yes, she is the guard in Con Air. That's right. She's the one that Danny Trejo's coming after. That's right. Fuck, she's in both of them. She did both of these plain action thrillers in 1997. Holy fucking shit. But what I'm getting at is that this movie came out in January probably because it had to. Because by the time you get to summer, you have two other films that bear some resemblance to it. Air Force One features a form of jumbo jet. I'm not positive specifically what the model number of the aircraft for Air Force One happens to be. I'm not that kind of guy. And Con Air has the psychopath in the air thing going for it. So both of these films are much, much better and feature components very similar to this one. So it had to come out in January is what I'm saying. And it's completely overshadowed by both of them in every way conceivable. In terms of exploring the premise, Con Air feels like what this ought to have been. Like, you may as well not bother with this kind of movie just because the chess pieces you have on the board that you have allotted yourself in trying to tell the story that Turbulence is trying to tell are not good pieces. Like you're kind of limping across the finish line when it comes to exhausting your options with what to do with those particular pieces. As I said, the first half of it's okay. You get a little bit of like a, is he actually the bad guy kind of thing with Ray Liotta? Because he has like kind of like a Ted Bundy thing going for him where he's obsessed with blonde ladies and he's articulate and personable and seems to have a great deal of empathy for other people on the flight. Then you have Brendan Gleeson, who seems like the more imminent threat because he's surly, huge. He is a bear man. And he does prove to be the more imminent threat because he is the one who triggers the crisis in the first place. That stuff was all kind of interesting, where it's like we're trying to figure out we know where the story's going to end up, kind of. Like, we know that there's going to be a crisis, but sussing out exactly how it comes about is kind of a suspenseful, kind of interesting process. to explain it, Brendan Gleeson is taken to use the restroom. Grandel Bush actually stands in the airplane toilet with him, having just gotten off a 737 just the other day. Can tell you, you would not be able to do that on that particular aircraft. Haven't been on a 747, since I was a little kid. Don't remember how big the turlets are on those. However, the set that they constructed, just to tell you how spacious it is, it's big enough to fit fucking Balrog from Street Fighter and fucking Man Bear Brendan Gleeson. Get the fuck away from me, Brendan Gleeson, in the same toilet stall. Huge airplane toilet is what I'm getting at. But Brendan Gleeson pulls the soap dispenser plunger out of the sink, and for some reason it has this like 6-inch fucking metal syringe as a part of the plunger. Like, I guess, yeah, you know how it has like a pointy straw thing? Like, usually it's made of plastic these days. In the 90s, we made everything of steel, like Grandpa's day. Basically, he pulls this giant, like, 6-inch syringe out, and he stabs Grandel Bush in the abdomen and kills him, and takes his pistol, uses him as a human shield, and then proceeds to just run out into the aisle and get in a fucking gunfight on a plane in flight. They do puncture a hole in one of the windows in the plane, and it does affect the cabin pressure briefly. Unfortunately, we don't get a Goldfinger situation where somebody gets sucked out the fucking window. I was really kind of hoping that was going to happen, but no, they plug it up with like a fucking briefcase or something. It's kind of lame. But yeah, he gets in this gun battle, and immediately I get really frustrated because I'm counting the number of people on this plane. And I'm picturing this as being kind of like a slasher in the air kind of situation. I mean, Wes Craven's Red Eye isn't really a slasher by any means. It doesn't have a huge body count or anything. But in terms of like having a scary guy on an airplane situation, much better film. I will also point out the Liam Neeson film Nonstop. I think that's a Jaume Collet-Serrat film. It has visual flair for days. And it's a fun little mystery action thriller in the sky. I enjoy that one. That's one of the pretty good ones. One of their pretty good collaborations. So better action thrillers that take place on passenger planes. The Nonstop and Wes Craven's Red Eye. Check those out. But what I'm saying about the body count is that I'm watching how many people are getting shot, and I'm getting alarmed because I'm like, oh no, there's not going to be anybody left, and we're not even halfway through this fucker. Like, what are we going to do for the rest of it? It's like, are we really just going to have like a quote cat and mouse thing for the whole movie between Ray Liotta and I didn't remember her name when I was watching the film. Like I said, I had to look it up. Lauren Holly, former wife of Jim Carrey. Is it really just going to be the two of them? And spoiler alert, yeah, I said it before. That is unfortunately what it is. So my, like, one of my first biggest complaints was that you killed way too many people too quickly. And it extends even further to Brendan Gleeson himself. Spoiler alert. He kills almost all of the air marshals. I think there's like five of them. There was five of them. Five of them. Jesus. Brad from the Cinema Speak podcast doesn't know where that comes from, but he most definitely knows that quote. You're welcome, by the way, Brad. He kills like five of the air marshals, and there's like one left, and he's holding him. He's using the last one as a human shield, and amidst the kerfuffle, Ray Liotta manages to get a hold of one of the Glocks, and because Brendan Gleeson gets frustrated, I'm a little frazzled, but Brendan Gleeson is holding one of the agents, or Lauren Holly, I can't remember who. He's holding somebody hostage, and Ray Liotta, of all people, aka the serial killer on board, is the one to talk him down from executing his hostage, because Brendan Gleeson is operating from the assumption that he's going to death row as soon as he gets off the plane. He's got nothing to lose. He's going to take everybody down with him. Funny enough, Ray Liotta kind of adopts this mindset like an hour later in the film. He doesn't have it right now. He gets there, though, for some reason. But Ray Liotta talks him down somehow. And then Brendan Gleeson gets all ornery and pulls aside the last remaining air marshal and demands that the air marshal open one of the exit doors and jump out of the plane. It's like, I don't think that's how that works. Ray Liotta is like, dude, that's not how that works. And he's not listening. And then what finally gets Ray Liotta to take action is Brendan Gleeson strikes Lauren Holly, who, as I mentioned, Ray Liotta has developed a fascination in because she is blonde and he's been trying to chat her up the entire time they've been in flight. He like bops her with his elbow, and apparently Ray Liotta gets mad about that and he shoots Brendan Gleeson, who then reflexively shoots the air marshal who he was threatening to jump out the plane. And I'm just sitting here and I'm just like, oh my God, everybody's dead already. And by the way, all of the other passengers, there are civilian passengers on this plane, have zero character. I think the only character any of them had is that there's a teenager who's playing a Game Boy and has a skateboard. He's a typical 90s kid. And then there's a grandma who I loved watching her stunt actor like fly out of her seat and bash her head on the ceiling. You get to see your grandma fly up into the ceiling of the plane when it starts losing altitude. It's pretty great. I don't know what it is, seeing like some stunt player in pads wearing a grandma costume slam into the ceiling. It's just kind of funny. If you've ever seen that Angels versus Demons movie, Legion, don't. But I remember going to the theater to see that purely on the strength of the teaser trailer for that movie because my friend was kind of obsessed. Same friend who loves The Saint, by the way. My friend was kind of obsessed with the sequence where the grandma turns into a spider lady and jumps up on the ceiling and says, "You're all gonna fucking die." I don't know what it is about crazy, crazy old ladies doing flips and stuff, but it always makes me laugh. Same goes for the opening of J.J. Perry's Day Shift. I love that opening. Jamie Foxx versus a contortionist vampire grandma. Good times, man. Good times. But yeah, this grandma, she like slams her head into the fucking ceiling of the plane. But that's the extent of her character. Like, that's it. There's an old man and an old woman, a teenager, a guy who doesn't like how flamboyant one of the flight attendants is. He doesn't have any dialogue, as far as I can tell. There are people on this plane, but the movie pays no mind to them. It doesn't even attempt to characterize them. And in fact, as I said, there is a part of this movie where Ray Liotta gathers everybody up and says, "Hey, we forgot to write any dialogue for y'all into the script. How about y'all camp out in this closet back here for the rest of the movie?" And that is what happened. We never even cut back to them. Like, the door shuts and those people are never seen again for like another hour. It is embarrassing. Like it's kind of basic shit where it's like, maybe cut to them and maybe have them do like a United 93 thing where like they're scheming or conspiring or being like, "Hey man, like there's a psychopath on the plane. And hey, a couple of the flight attendants aren't in here with us. I think they're still alive. Maybe we should do something. We should do something." Nope. We don't even bother. It's a little silly. It's a little short-sighted, is what I'm saying. And that's probably the most annoying thing about the movie is seeing it just knock pieces off the board. Like, bang, bang, bang. We're going to kill this guy. We're going to kill this guy. We're going to kill Brendan Gleeson. Even though he's a man bear and he's always great in everything he does. We're going to kill fucking Balrog. All these people are going into the closet. We're never even going to talk to them again. This entire movie's going to rest on Ray Liotta's shoulders, and we're not going to even tell him what to do. Because his probably the biggest thing that I haven't mentioned up until now, I did say that he is the fucking Joker in this. He basically is. The biggest thing to say about this movie is Ray Liotta's performance about halfway through the movie goes from being kind of nuanced and kind of dimension to he just turns into a goddamn cartoon character. Like, but not a good one. Like, he has a couple of lines here and there that are actually kind of endearing. Like, probably my favorite is when he accidentally shocks himself and he's like talking to circuit panels as if they're people. And he's like, we're going to invite you to the party and you and you and you. And then he grabs one, it shocks him. And he's like, oh, maybe not you. And the delivery is good. Like, it's actually kind of funny. Like, the best line to me though was, his leg gets caught in a door and he's like hanging upside down. He does a lot of screaming in this movie, like a lot of, kind of like, not like a Brad Dourif Chucky, like, kind of screams, but like, kind of screams, kind of pitiful screams, honestly. He gets beat the fuck up in this movie. And he's like using objects in the environment to like grab a tool to help him escape. And he mutters to himself something along the lines of like, that's like one thing I can say that my dad taught me, and like, that's how to fish. I completely butchered that, but it was actually kind of good. But yeah, his performance takes this turn almost exactly at the midway point of the movie where he grabs somebody's credit card, slides it through like one of the phones on the 747, and calls the detective who arrested him, and then proceeds to chew him out, cuss him out, and then confess to all of his crimes. Because at the drop of a hat, he just kind of adopts Brendan Gleeson's mindset of, as soon as the plane lands, my life is over anyway, so I'm going to take everybody down. I'm going to crash the plane in a blaze of glory. And so he becomes completely unhinged from then on out. And I referred to him as the Joker, but more accurately, he's probably more similar to, and this is really mean, the people who know will know, kind of similar to Tommy Lee Jones as Two-Face in Batman Forever. That is to say, a lot of inane, pointless chuckling, and just a lot of cartoonish antics in places where it's just simply not warranted. Tommy Lee Jones's performance as Two-Face is very, very frustrating to me, and a lot of people, honestly, because you can tell that he was probably more than a little bit frustrated having to work opposite Jim Carrey at the peak of his powers, on a production wherein everything that Jim Carrey was offering was what Schumacher and seemingly by extension the producers were encouraging and wanting. It's like, well, where does that leave me? It's like, well, I mean, you're coming off of The Fugitive. You're like one of the most sought after character actors in Hollywood at the moment. It's a Batman movie. Like, we're going to throw every dollar we have at you. You're going to accept those dollars. Just wear the makeup and show up, Tommy. And unfortunately, that's kind of what it seems happened at some point. Where it's like, I'm sure there were takes. There are takes that exist. And I do know there is kind of a grassroots movement to get a, quote, Schumacher cut out there of a more mature version, a more serious version of Batman Forever out there. I'm sure there were takes where he showed the fuck up. But the way I read it, and this is just me making assumptions, the way I read his performance in that is that this is a man who's just fucking frustrated and perhaps a little bit fatigued attempting to keep up with, you know, the fucking human lightning bolt that is Jim Carrey from the 90s, in a film that unfortunately made very little room for additional characterization or characters for that matter. That movie is basically the Riddler show with some Batman. Oh yeah, and Chris O'Donnell's here too. And Don the Dragon Wilson. From the halfway mark, it's basically just Ray Liotta being a cartoonish supervillain kind of character, constantly chasing Lauren Holly, but very seldom like legitimately threatening her. I will say, one of those details that I probably should have thrown out there at the top, the cinematography for the movie is pretty all right. It's kind of a handsome movie, although the opticals, like the, not the opticals, but like the compositing work in the film for like the exterior shots of the plane in flight, they're a little raggedy, especially by 1997 standards, when again, we were seeing a lot of other aircraft-oriented films that had much better effects than this, so it doesn't do the film any favors. But in terms of like shot compositions and lighting, it's motivated. I can say that much. Like there is motivation and theory going on behind the shot selections and the editing. There's a recurring design motif in the construction of the shots that I found interesting, but also somewhat frustrating. And that is having obscuring light blooms, often colored, like colored light blooms, in the foreground of shot compositions. So if you don't wear glasses, this might be hard to understand. I do wear glasses, so this is something I see all the time. It's kind of like what happens when you have drops of water on your glasses and there's like a light source shooting light into that drop of water, and you get these little light blooms that pop up in the forefront of your vision. It's that effect, and it's very intentional. It's done constantly throughout the film. And also another one of those major details, probably should point out at the top of this discussion, this is technically a Christmas film. This film takes place on just Christmas Eve, I believe, December 24th. And as a result, I forget which Christmas carol it is, but it's the it's that Christmas carol, whatever it's called. Shirley Walker incorporates that into the score as a recurring motif. A little on the nose, Shirley, being as, you know, Ode to Joy was incorporated into Die Hard. Michael Kamen's score for Die Hard, that is. And the light bloom effect, the aforementioned light bloom effect used in a lot of the cinematography throughout the film, makes ample use of the Christmas decorations strewn about the plane, serving as like logical reasons for those artifacts to appear in the frame. Interesting stuff. I don't know if I actually like it, but it's interesting. I give it that much. But yeah, the vast majority of the movie is unfortunately just Ray Liotta chasing Lauren Holly up and down the aisles of the plane. And it's literally that, because again, it's a fucking corridor. There's nowhere really to go. And at one point she like panics and she does this thing where I guess it's supposed to be her like tapping into muscle memory as she's experiencing panic, because she like picks something up off the floor because the plane is in distress and things are falling out of the baggage, like the overhead storage. And she like picks up a jacket or something that fell out of the overhead storage and stows it, and then sits down and then buckles her seatbelt. And it's like, it's not illogical. It makes sense. It's just really funny to see happen in the middle of a crisis situation where it's like, I wouldn't expect to see Harrison Ford do that. Like that doesn't seem like the right move to make, lady. Like the serial killer guy's like right over there. Maybe don't be here. Also important thing to note, the pilot is shot during the fracas, like at the outset of the crisis situation. So I guess kind of similar to Speed, where the bus driver is shot in the back pretty early, like pretty soon after Keanu Reeves gets on the bus from Speed. But yeah, the pilot is killed and the co-pilot is concussed and later dies. It's like teased for a little bit that he might be able to help at some point, but no, he's dead too. And it's like, God damn it, man. Like, just killing everybody before they can even do anything. And it really does come down to just Lauren Holly and Ray Liotta. And because it's a 747, and I guess it's just not logical for her to be trained in how to land the plane. And also maybe it's a little bit of a flex from the Boeing company or something to show that, hey, we can land our planes with computers now. It's like, well, it doesn't bode well for the pilots, man. Like I'd like to at least believe that they're doing something up there. It's like, but what I'm getting at is we do the whole airplane/airport thing where she has to be talked over the radio, instructed over the radio when she gains access to the cockpit and is able to get away from Ray Liotta. The half dozen or so times she does in the movie, Because she constantly going in there and leaving. It's so fucking frustrating. Just lock the fucking door. You'll be fine. He doesn't break down the door until like the end of the movie. So you can get the Here's Johnny shot. I guess they had to save something for the final reel. But when they're talking to her over the radio, it's all just like, push this button, push that button. Maybe don't press that button. Don't touch that. It's like super dry. It's like tech support, basically. It's not, because it's a 747 and it has a sophisticated autopilot and stuff. It's not like Speed, where there's like maneuvering and stuff that has to be done, where it's like, oh, we gotta escape these storm clouds. It's like, oh, I gotta teach you how to like ascend above the clouds and escape the storm. And it's like, oh, the electricals are going out. You need to reboot them. Do this and this and this. Oh, Mr. Arnold, there's your arm. What happened? Oh, there's a raptor on board. Oh no, I stumbled ass backwards into a way better movie. Raptors on a plane. It's all just like, press that button. Don't press that one. Don't touch that. What are you doing? I didn't tell you to do that. It's really dry and really boring. And because it's just the two of them, like her one flight attendant friend has like a tense confrontation with Ray Liotta that does result, as I said, in a pretty savage strangling. Like, it's actually a pretty savage killing, and it is set up pretty well. And Ray Liotta, to his credit, does play a pretty solid creepy guy when he's not being like fucking, was it Frank Gorshin Riddler from the fucking Adam West Batman show? Like, when before he goes full crazy, like when he's still simmering, he does some good work. Like, he has a couple of confrontations with Lauren Holly and Catherine Hicks as her friend, the other flight attendant, that are actually kind of gripping and kind of creepy, and culminating with that sequence where he chokes her to death. It's pretty savage. She acts the shit out of it, by the way. But it's like immediately after that, that he locks everybody up, or immediately before that, I believe, where he locks everybody up. But because our options are so limited, like, we just keep having to find excuses for Lauren Holly to leave the cockpit. And at first it's kind of cute, where it's like, well, Ray Liotta did kind of like save her from Brendan Gleeson. He was kind of charming up until then. He was shown to be kind of empathetic and magnanimous. So it's like, you know, I guess you could reason that like maybe she trusts him a little bit or something, even though she knows he's a fucking serial killer. That's one of those things that like maybe better script would have concealed that fact. Like, maybe don't let her know what his crimes were. So it makes more sense for her to trust him even a little bit. It's like, dude, he's got a body count and he's a serial killer and he's interested in you. No, you don't trust that guy. Like, especially as a young woman, absolutely do not trust anything that man says. But for some reason she does. And she keeps listening to him and she keeps entertaining his attempts to get her to come out. And it's so contrived and sloppy. Like, she comes across as really fucking stupid, is what I'm saying. And it happens multiple times in the film. And it's really fucking frustrating. And then things are not helped by the quote, action climax of the movie kind of being her having to land the plane, which, again, is done entirely via autopilot. So it just comes down to her pressing buttons. And then literally the conclusion of the film, the landing of the plane, like the culmination of all her hard work and stuff is... So the flight stick's going to move, but I don't want you to touch it. You pressed all the correct buttons, just let the computer do it. It's like, oh, so, you know what tends to make things more interesting is like when there's like a last minute like crisis or something, or, you know, maybe there's a little bit of luck or a little bit of faith or something. Like say, for instance, like Star Wars. Like, if I, you know what would make the end of A New Hope way better? If like Luke's targeting computer actually worked and he didn't have to use the force and he just kind of like beep 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 and shot and it worked. That would make for a way better movie. That's fucking cinema. Interesting example I just pulled out of my ass. But yeah, she has to land the plane and it's just like doop doop dop and then she lands. But prior to that, she has to dispatch Ray Liotta and involves her obtaining a revolver, which was stowed in the cockpit. And then separately, she has to find a bullet for the revolver. She puts it in, and long story short, she shoots him in the head. Earlier in the movie, there is kind of a nifty, quote, action sequence where he's chasing her, and the plane, like, does a barrel roll, to quote fucking Pepe from Star Fox, do a barrel roll. The 747 does a fucking barrel roll in a storm, no less. Sure. And you get like a rotating room effect, something Wes Craven is intimately familiar with, like a rotating room effect, where you get to see the plane get turned upside down, all the baggage and stuff, which it's a lot of baggage. That's a lot of stuff in overhead storage for a flight with only 11 people on it. That hadn't occurred to me until just now, but yeah, that doesn't make sense now, does it? Those effects were kind of neat. Whoever was operating the strobe lighting in the film also deserves, whatever they were paid, and then some, because they put in work. Did quite a lot to lend some atmosphere and some gravitas to Ray Liotta's bad guy performance. And then there is a bit where... Oh yeah, the avionics bay. There's an odd bit, or speaking of things that don't make a lick of sense, there's like a last minute attempt at like making a crisis, an additional crisis, in landing the plane, where it's like, okay, well, autopilot will land the plane. As long as you doop-doop-dop correctly, like you press these buttons and don't touch anything, you'll be fine. There's like a monkey wrench tossed into things in the form of Ray Liotta going into the avionics bay and breaking shit. One of which is a panel labeled very clearly autopilot, autopilot master control or something along those lines. And he takes like a hand axe to it. He smashes it. What I'm saying here that doesn't make sense is that happens probably 15 minutes before the plane lands via autopilot. It's like, huh, I thought he smashed that. I thought we didn't have that anymore. But no, that's exactly what we use. That's exactly what we do. It's like, oh, okay, well, okay. no internal logic. It's kind of... That's how you can tell that a movie isn't working. Like, in terms of engagement, that's that very important phrase, that very important word that Kyle has kind of taught me to focus in on when it comes to watching movies and finding value in movies. Engagement is kind of everything to Kyle in a lot of ways. If it can't hold his attention, that means that's a knock against its overall quality. That means there's something wrong with what's with the product. If he can't latch onto it, like if he can't find a way to be interested in it all the way through. What I'm trying to emphasize here is that when I'm nitpicking things like this, when I'm having more fun poking holes in the logic of the thing than actually watching the damn movie, that's how you can tell that it's not working. Is when my brain is going to the places that it is right now doing this podcast. But yeah, long story short, she shoots him in the fucking face. I could have used a couple more frames of the exit wound out the back of his head, because the couple of frames we got are pretty tasty. Like, by the way, the few instances of violence, again, almost entirely relegated to the first half hour of the movie, are pretty good. Like, we get some solid squibs in this movie. But, like I said, there's very little of it after that opening sequence. And then when he gets shot in the head, it's like a couple of frames too short, but you can tell that was some Verhoeven shit. Like that was a good head explosion is what I'm saying. But it cuts a little bit quick, probably to avoid like an X rating or something, but he gets shot in the face, he's dead. We unfortunately don't get the slasher movie thing where he comes back for like one more round or something, or one last scare, to use the Scream parlance. But the plane lands, and then she, it's implied as far as I can tell, that when she encounters Ben Cross in uniform, in dress uniform, by the way, waiting for her with an umbrella when she exits the plane. It seems to be implied that they're gonna like get together. They're gonna fuck is what I'm saying. Probably not become a couple, but they are definitely fucking. I mean, they're both in the flight business. It's been a long day. Let's get to fucking and then get back to flying 40 hours straight, because as far as I know, those people are super overworked. But yeah, that's kind of the end of the movie. It's not very good. But now I've seen it, and I never have to think about it or talk about it ever again. Although I will quite enjoy, you know, the situation that will never arise, wherein somebody will be asking about Turbulence, and I'll be able to put my finger up and I'll be like, yo, I'm your guy. You want to know about Turbulence? I can tell you about Turbulence. I am that guy. I seen that movie. Yeah, Turbulence from 1997, directed by Robert Butler. And yeah, it's kind of unfortunate to end Action August on such a whimper, on such a wet noodle. Brad from the Cinema Speak podcast will know what drop I wish I could be playing right now. But that them's the breaks. My alternate choice probably should have been Con Air, honestly. But that's a movie that I need Kyle for, because it's a Nick Cage movie. It has an unbelievable cast. I have a lot of things to say about Con Air, is what I'm getting at. I've seen it a lot. It was on cable constantly. Con Air probably should have been the pick. But actually, what I had slotted for the last week this month originally was Hard Rain, which is the Christian Slater and Morgan Freeman headlined flood movie. It's like a heist in the midst of a flood kind of situation, kind of similar to the Hurricane heist, I guess. Although clearly not as over the top. I saw that one on VHS when it came out. I think my mom rented it. Don't remember it at all, other than I remember the Morgan Freeman character's, his actions in the film being inconsistent. And I think it had to do with just like Morgan Freeman's general reputation as an actor at that time or something. Like, it's like, we can't have him be that bad a guy, you know, he's Morgan Freeman. That's all I remember about that movie, though. But yeah, that was originally my pick, but I figured, you know, hey, it's just me, I'm not feeling well, I want some easy homework, so I'll watch a shitty movie and talk about it by myself, with myself, for just over an hour. So yeah, that was Turbulence from 1997, directed by Robert Butler. If you'd like to catch up on any of our other Catching Up on Cinema content, you can find all of that collected on our website at catchinguponcinema.com. You can also find us on the social medias in the form of the Instagram at Catching Up on Cinema, as well as Twitter /X at Catching Cinema. So feel free to hit me up at either of those. And the podcast is available on pretty much every platform you can imagine, including Bitcade. So fucking Google it. And that being said, thank you so much for listening, and we will catch you next time.